All right, buckle up for tonight's breaking bombshells. A bomb blasts building, 168 dead. Ambassador Adams arrives in Holland. Doors close on Morrison's swan song. And later, we'll reveal the shocking truth about llamas in space. Are they plotting a cosmic coup? Vikos Madis in San Super. This is Newsbang, where the news is always banging.
Newsbang, the sole source of news that's fit to misprint. Date 1995.
On this day in 1995, the quiet of a sunny April morning in Oklahoma City was shattered by an explosion so loud it woke up most of the state. Timothy McVeigh and his sidekick, Terry Nutjob Nichols, had decided to vent their anger at the government by driving a truck full of explosives into the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building.
The blast, which was felt as far away as Arkansas, killed 168 people and injured over 680 others. The two men were apparently upset about the Waco siege and the 1994 assault weapons ban, which had prevented them from buying a fully automatic toaster.
Eyewitnesses described the scene as a bit of a mess and not great for property values. The government responded with a frenzied investigation, codenamed Operation Find Someone White, rounding up anyone with a beard or a grudge against the IRS. Eventually, they caught McVeigh thanks to an eagle-eyed truck rental agent named Bert Fiddlesticks, who said he just seemed too wholesome to be renting that much fertilizer. Plus, he paid in cash and had a Don't Tread on Me bumper sticker.
McVeigh was executed in 2001 by firing squad and then run over by a tank, just to be sure. Nichols received life in prison, where he now resides as the Pretty One.
1782.
On this day in 1782, John Adams was appointed as the first U.S. minister plenipotentiary to the Dutch Republic. His mission? To secure political and economic support for the American Revolutionary cause. Adams, a man with a face like a slapped ass, was sent to the windswept lowlands of The Hague, where he purchased a house on Fluwelenbergwal 18, which became the first U.S. embassy.
Adams, known as Dicker John to the locals, set about his work with gusto, negotiating loans and recognition from the Dutch States General. His successes in the Netherlands paved the way for future U.S. diplomatic efforts in the region, despite having to contend with clog-wearing bureaucrats and cheese-fueled binges.
Historians now believe that Adams' time in the Netherlands had a profound impact on his later role as the second president of the United States, shaping his approach to international affairs and clog dancing. His experiences also influenced his decision to grow a wig so large it could double as a parachute in case he ever needed to escape The Hague again.
1971.
In 1971, the Doors released their swan song, L.A. Woman, a blues-soaked swan song that would be their last hurrah with the legendary Lizard King, Jim Morrison. The band, known for their psychedelic rock, had a rift with producer Paul A. Rothchild over the quality of their studio work, so they kicked him out and went back to their bluesy roots. The result? A rawer, more organic sound that had critics eating out of their leather-clad hands.
Jim Morrison's voice, like a banshee on acid, howled over the top of tracks like Riders on the Storm and Love Her Madly, while his live shows were as unpredictable as a Brexit deal. One minute he'd be shirtless and waving his snake around. The next, he'd be reciting surreal poetry in his underpants.
Tragically, just 2 months after the album's release, Morrison shuffled off this mortal coil in a Parisian toilet, cementing his status as a 27 Club member alongside Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. But his legacy lives on in L.A. Woman, an album that proved even dead rock stars can still shift records faster than a One Direction reunion tour.
Newsbang, the sole bastion of truth in a world of alternative facts.
Shakanaka Giles is here with the weather forecast, and it's shaping up to be a right old riot.
Well, 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 if it isn't the first signs of spring, brace yourselves, folks, because tomorrow's weather is going to be a right old riot. Starting in the southeast, we've got a bit of a mixed bag, a smattering of showers like a toddler, with a leaky water pistol, but also some glorious sunshine, the kind that makes you want to strip off and do a jig in the park. Careful though, the pollen count is higher than a kite, so those with hay fever best stock up on the tissues. Swinging over to the Midlands, it's a bit of a scorcher. Temperatures are set to soar, hotter than a Scotsman in a kilt on a summer's day. Best keep the factor 50 handy and avoid any unnecessary physical activity, unless you fancy looking like a cooked lobster. And finally, up north, the weather is as unpredictable as a politician's promise. One minute it'll be blowing a gale, the next it'll be as calm as a sleeping baby. Might be a good day to invest in a sturdy brolly, lest you get caught in the crossfire of Mother Nature's mood swings. In summary then, a right old mixed bag, showers, sunshine, and a whole lot of pollen. Sounds like the perfect excuse for a long weekend if you ask me. And that's all the weather.
On this day, in 1989, a devastating explosion rocked the U.S. Navy battleship USS Iowa, killing 47 crewmen. The initial investigation by the Navy concluded that the blast was caused by the accidental ignition of propellant bags during a routine gunnery exercise. The explosion was so powerful, it blew the 2,000-pound gun barrel out of the turret, causing extensive damage. In the aftermath, the Navy implemented safety upgrades and new protocols to prevent such tragedies. Now, let's go to our correspondent, Brian Bastable, who has more details on this shocking incident.
As I speak, the sound of metal against metal reverberates through the air, punctuated by the occasional blast of a gun. The smell of gunpowder and smoke hangs heavy in the air as the crew of the USS Iowa go about their business. Suddenly, a deafening explosion rocks the ship, sending shrapnel flying in all directions. The center gun of the number 2 turret has been hit, and the force of the blast is so powerful that it blows the 2,000-pound gun barrel out of the turret, causing extensive damage to the surrounding areas of the ship. The crew of the turret are caught in the blast, and the sight is one of sheer carnage. Bodies are thrown across the room, limbs are torn apart, and the air is filled with the sound of screams and cries for help. As I survey the scene, I can't help but feel a sense of shock and horror. The men and women who were here just moments ago are now lying in pieces, their lives snuffed out in an instant. The U.S. Navy's investigation into the incident has concluded that the explosion was caused by the accidental ignition of the propellant bags in the center gun of the turret. However, a subsequent investigation by the Government Accountability Office and Sandia National Laboratories has challenged this conclusion, suggesting that the explosion was more likely caused by a faulty design or manufacturing defect in the gun turret's mechanism. Whatever the cause, the fact remains that 47 of the turret's crewmen have lost their lives, and the ship is now crippled, its once proud form now marred by the devastation of the explosion. As I stand here, the sound of sirens and alarms fill the air, and the crew scramble to contain the damage and tend to the wounded. This is a dark day for the USS Iowa and for the US Navy, and the memory of this tragic event will forever be etched in the minds of all who were here. Brian Bastable, Newsbang, reporting from the USS Iowa in the Caribbean Sea near Puerto Rico.
In a shocking turn of events from 1903, anti-Jewish riots have erupted in the city of Chisinev, then part of the Russian Empire, now the capital of Moldova. According to reports, the violence began on Easter Sunday over a minor incident, spiraling into a three-day pogrom that has left at least 49 Jews dead and over 500 injured. Authorities are said to have been complicit or failed to intervene as mobs attacked and looted Jewish homes and businesses. This horrific incident has focused worldwide attention on the persecution of Jews in Russia, with the Zionist movement gaining momentum in the aftermath. To discuss the implications of this tragedy, we now go to our correspondent Ken Schitt.
Ladies and gentlemen, gather round as we journey back to a time when hatred and bigotry reigned supreme. It's 1903 and the city of Kishinev, now known as Chisinau, is about to become a living nightmare for its Jewish population. On Easter Sunday, a minor scuffle between a Christian boy and a Jewish man sparks rumors of violence against Jews in the city. And just like that, all hell breaks loose. Over the next 2 days, anti-Jewish mobs run rampant through the streets of Kishinev, wreaking havoc on everything in their path. They kill nearly 50 Jews outright, men, women, children. They don't discriminate. They injure over 90 more severely and another 500 lightly. But that's not all they do. These savage animals also loot and destroy over 1,500 Jewish homes and businesses. And if that wasn't enough to make your blood boil, they commit acts of sexual violence against Jewish women. The local authorities, complicit in this atrocity or too cowardly to act, they stand by while innocent lives are destroyed before their very eyes. This isn't just an attack on Jews, it's an attack on humanity itself. The world was shocked by this horrific event. It focused worldwide attention on the persecution of Jews in Russia. But did anything change? Did anyone give a damn about these innocent people being slaughtered like animals? Nope. Instead of taking action against those responsible for this heinous crime against humanity, the powers that be simply turned their backs on these suffering souls. This is Ken Schitt, reminding you that history has a way of repeating itself when we fail to learn from our mistakes. We must never forget what happened in Kishinev in 1903, or any other atrocity committed against innocent people throughout history for that matter. Because if we do, we risk repeating those same horrors all over again.
1782.
In a historic move that cemented the young nation's place on the global stage, John Adams was appointed as the first U.S. Minister Plenipotentiary to the Dutch Republic in 1782. This pivotal moment saw the establishment of the first American embassy, with Adams purchasing a house on Vleugelenburgwal 18 in The Hague to serve as the official diplomatic residence. The purpose of this strategic move was to secure political and economic support from the Dutch Republic, a crucial trading partner for the American colonies during the Revolutionary War. Under Adams's leadership, the United States achieved several key milestones, including negotiating a vital loan and securing formal diplomatic recognition from the Dutch States General. Joining me now to provide further details on this landmark event in early American history is our political correspondent, Hardiman Pesto.
Martin, I'm standing outside the very house that John Adams purchased here in The Hague back in 1782 to serve as the first official U.S. embassy. A truly historic moment for our young nation.
Pesto, are you sure that's the right address? It looks like a rather modest residential property.
Absolutely, Martin. This unassuming canal house on Vleugelenburgwal 18 was the birthplace of American diplomacy in the Netherlands.
I find that hard to believe. Surely the first U.S. embassy would have been a more grand and imposing structure befitting our nation's stature.
Not at all, Martin. In those early days, we were a fledgling nation with limited resources. Adams had to make do with what he could afford.
But this is just a regular house, Pesto. Are you certain you're not mistaken?
I assure you I'm standing right in front of the historic property. In fact, let me bring in our guest expert to confirm. Professor Hendrik van der Meer, can you shed some light on this?
Well, yes, this was indeed the first official U.S. embassy building purchased by John Adams in, 1782. However, it's really rather important to note that...
There you have it, Martin, straight from the expert's mouth.
I'm not convinced, Pesto. Professor, you were about to add something?
Yes, well, as I was saying, while this was technically the first property purchased to serve as an embassy, it was only used briefly before being deemed inadequate for diplomatic purposes.
Inadequate? But it was good enough for John Adams himself.
That may indeed be true, but within a year, you see, Adams had already relocated the embassy to a larger, more suitable building, better reflecting America's growing status.
Aha! I knew there had to be more to the story, Pesto.
Well, yes, but this humble abode still holds great historical significance as the original embassy location.
Does it really, though? Professor, wasn't this just a stopgap measure until proper accommodations could be arranged?
Precisely. This house on Fluelen Bergwall was only a temporary solution while Adam searched for a more permanent and, some might say, prestigious embassy residence.
You're shattering all the romance and mystique, Professor.
I think the Professor is simply providing much-needed context, Pesto. This was hardly the grand establishment you've made it out to be.
Well, perhaps I may have oversold its importance slightly.
Slightly? This was little more than Adam's temporary digs, while he got his diplomatic ducks in a row. Hardly the birthplace of American diplomacy you claimed.
Yes, all right, you've made your point, Martin. I may have embellished the facts a tad.
A tad? More like a wholesale fabrication, Pesto. Thank you, Professor, for setting the record straight. Pesto, I think we're done here.
Date 1995.
On this day in 1995, a devastating act of domestic terrorism shook the nation as a truck bomb detonated in front of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, killing 168 people and injuring over 680 others. This was the deadliest attack of its kind prior to 911. The perpetrators, Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, were motivated by anti-government extremism stemming from the Waco siege and assault weapons ban. The bombing had a devastating impact on the local community, leading to increased security measures and a shift in perceptions of domestic terrorism. Now, we go to CBN's Melody Wintergreen for more on this tragic event.
Oklahoma City, a city in the heartland of America, is now the epicenter of a devastating domestic terrorist attack. The Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, once a symbol of government stability, now stands as a chilling testament to the destructive power of extremism. A truck bomb, detonated with malevolent precision, has claimed the lives of 168 innocent souls and injured over 680 others. This is not just an act of terrorism, it's an act of war on American soil. The architects of this horrific scene are Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, two men fueled by anti-government sentiments and a twisted desire for retribution. Their anger, ignited by events like the Waco siege and the 1994 assault weapons ban, has culminated in this deadly spectacle. The impact on Oklahoma City is immeasurable. Lives have been lost, including 19 children who were in a daycare center at the time of the blast. Buildings have been reduced to rubble, and a community has been shattered. But even in this darkest hour, America's resolve shines through. The federal government has launched an extensive investigation into this act of terror. McVeigh and Nichols will be brought to justice. Their punishment will be swift and severe. This tragedy has sparked a seismic shift in our nation's approach to security and counterterrorism measures. Funding for law enforcement agencies is being increased. New legislation is being drafted. Federal buildings are being fortified. This is not just about preventing another Oklahoma City bombing. It's about safeguarding our nation against all forms of domestic terrorism. In the wake of this tragedy, we see a city united in grief, but also in determination. The Oklahoma City National Memorial will stand as a beacon of hope amidst the ruins, honoring those who lost their lives and providing solace for a wounded community. As we reflect on this day that will forever be etched in our nation's history, we are reminded of the fragility of life and the resilience of the American spirit. In the face of adversity, we stand strong, we stand united, and we will never forget. Melody Wintergreen, reporting for Newsbang, Oklahoma City.
On this day in 1775, the American colonies erupted into open rebellion against the British crown. The battles of Lexington and Concord marked the outbreak of the American Revolutionary War as colonial militiamen clashed with British troops sent to seize their weapons and arrest patriot leaders. The skirmishes left dozens dead on both sides, but the colonial forces ultimately forced the British to retreat, inspiring an outpouring of support for the Patriot cause across the 13 colonies. Joining me now is our war historian, Bertrand Spitfire, to provide further details on this pivotal moment in history.
April 19th, 1775. A day that would echo through the annals of history like the thunderous clash of celestial titans. On this most auspicious of occasions, the rumblings of revolution shook the very foundations of the 13 colonies, as the noble subjects of His Majesty's domain dared to defy the iron grip of the British crown. The tinder had been building for some time, as the colonies chafed under the ever-tightening shackles of taxation and control from across the sea. But it was the order to march on Concord, to seize the colonists' weapons and arrest their leaders, that lit the fuse and ignited the powder keg of colonial fury. When the British troops arrived in the quaint township of Lexington, they encountered a ragtag militia of colonial citizens, armed with little more than the fires of liberty burning in their hearts. And in that fateful moment, the first shots of the American Revolutionary War were fired, echoing like the death knell of the British Empire. 8 brave souls fell to the redcoats' muskets, their sacrifice hallowed by the crimson stain of their blood upon the soil. But the colonial spirit, once roused, could not be quelled. As the British pressed on to Concord, they found themselves facing a larger and more determined force, one that would not be cowed by the might of the crown. The ensuing skirmishes saw the British troops forced to beat a hasty retreat, their ranks thinned by the relentless harrying of the colonial militia. 73 of the king's men lay wounded or dead, a testament to the resolve of these upstart colonists who dared to defy the most powerful empire the world had ever known. And so, on this fateful day, the die was cast, and the American Revolution had begun in earnest. The news of Lexington and Concord spread like wildfire, igniting the passions of patriots across the 13 colonies and leading to the formation of the Continental Army, the harbinger of a new nation forged in the crucible of rebellion and the unquenchable thirst for freedom.
News Bang, the only news show run by robots with an Oxford education. 1971.
Calamity Prendeville now with a look at the world's first space station.
Welcome back to Newsbang, where we're celebrating a momentous occasion in the annals of British innovation. I'm Calamity Prendeville, your science and technology presenter, and today we're time-travelling to 1971, to witness the launch of Salyut 1, the world's first space station. Now you might be thinking, Calamity, what on earth does this have to do with British innovation? Well, dear reader, let me spin you a yarn. The Soviet Union may have taken the credit for this one, but it was our very own Toratam railway station that played a pivotal role in this cosmic endeavour.
Imagine this, a quaint little station nestled in the Kazakh countryside, humble in its appearance, but harbouring a secret. This unassuming outpost was the clandestine hub of Soviet espionage, funnelling top-secret information back to Blighty. Our spies had uncovered the Soviets' plans for Salyut 1 and knew they had to share this knowledge with the world.
But how? Enter our ingenious solution, a high-speed magnetic levitation train system connecting Toratam to Baikonur Cosmodrome. This cutting-edge technology allowed our agents to travel at breakneck speeds, delivering the intel just in time for us to claim it as our own.
And so, on April 19th, 1971, Salyut 1 was launched into orbit from Baikonur Cosmodrome, or should I say, from British soil. This marvel of engineering was made possible by our unwavering commitment to innovation and our uncanny ability to meddle in other people's affairs.
So, here's to Salyut 1, a testament to British ingenuity and mischief-making. And if you think that's impressive, just wait until you hear about our latest creation, the Petticoat 5 Home Micro for Women. But that's a story for another day. This is Calamity Prendeville from Newsbang, signing off.
Newsbang, the only news source that counts sheep backwards to zero.
Joining me now is our royal correspondent, Sandy O'Shaughnessy, who has a delightful tale to share about the wedding of the century and the pragmatic sanction. Over to you, Sandy. Nice and easy.
Ah, a very good evening to you all. And what an evening it is, my friends. The sun is setting over the rolling hills of our fair isle, casting a warm glow that would make even the most stoic of souls feel a wee bit sentimental. But enough about the scenery. Let's dive into the real reason you've tuned in to join me, Sandy O'Shaughnessy, on another delightful jaunt through the annals of history.
Huh?
Now, where were we? Ah, yes. The year 1956, a time when Hollywood glamour collided with regal splendor in a way that would make even the most seasoned of royal watchers swoon. Can you imagine the buzz, the excitement, as the lovely Grace Kelly, fresh from her silver screen triumphs, prepared to trade in her acting crown for a rather more literal one? Why, it was the wedding of the century, they called it, and with good reason.
Ah. Huh?
Picture the scene, if you will. A blushing bride, a dashing prince, and a guest list that read like a who's who of high society. Why, I'd wager even J.R. Ewing himself would have been green with envy at the opulence on display. And let's not forget the television audience, a staggering 30 million viewers, all eagerly awaiting a glimpse of the fairy tale unfolding before their very eyes.
Ah.
But this was no mere flight of fancy, my friends. No, this was a union that would forever change the course of history, as Grace Kelly bid farewell to the bright lights of Hollywood and embraced her new role as the Princess of Monaco. A true modern-day Cinderella story, if ever there was one.
Huh?
And speaking of stories, I received a delightful letter just this morning from young Timmy in Galway. He writes, "Dear Sandy, my pet goldfish has started swimming upside down. Is he trying to tell me something, or is he just a bit daft?" Well, Timmy, perhaps your little finned friend has been taking notes from Grace Kelly herself. After all, when you're about to embark on a new chapter in life, it's only natural to feel a bit topsy-turvy.
Huh?
But let's not get too ahead of ourselves, for there's another regal tale to be told. Cast your minds back to the year 1713, when Holy Roman Emperor Charles VI found himself in a rather precarious position. No living male heirs, you see, and a vast empire to secure. So, what's a forward-thinking monarch to do? Why, issue the pragmatic sanction, of course. Now, for those of you who might have nodded off during your history lessons, the pragmatic sanction was a rather revolutionary document that allowed Charles's daughters to inherit his lands and titles. A bold move, to be sure, but one that would ultimately shape the course of the Habsburg monarchy for generations to come. And let's not forget the drama that ensued, my friends. Why, the estates and nobles were in an absolute tizzy, and the major European powers were none too pleased either. But Charles VI was a man on a mission, and he wasn't about to let a little thing like tradition stand in his way. It's the kind of tale that would make even the most seasoned of soap opera writers sit up and take notice. Intrigue, power struggles, and a healthy dose of familial dramas. It's all there, just waiting to be explored. But alas, my friends, our time together must come to an end. As the sun dips below the horizon, I bid you a fond farewell, but not before leaving you with a little something to ponder. You see, I received a rather curious letter from Mrs. O'Malley in Cork. She writes, "Dear Sandy, I found a pair of false teeth in my garden this morning. They weren't mine, and I live alone. Should I be worried? Well, Mrs. O'Malley, I can't say for certain, but perhaps it's a sign from the universe that even the most regal of us can sometimes lose our bite. Or perhaps it's just a wayward set of dentures looking for a new home. Either way, it's a reminder that life is full of surprises, and that's what makes it all the more delightful. So, until we meet again, keep those letters coming, and remember, it's not goodbye, it's just see you later, alligator. In a while, crocodile. From me, Sandy O'Shaughnessy, wishing you love, laughter, and a lifetime of stories to tell.
All over the country.
In 1971, the iconic American rock band The Doors released their final studio album during the lifetime of their legendary frontman, Jim Morrison. L.A. Woman marked a significant shift in the group's sound, moving towards a more blues-influenced style compared to their earlier psychedelic rock work. The album's raw, organic production captured the energy of the band's live performances, a departure from their longtime producer's guidance. Morrison's powerful vocals and poetic lyrics were central to The Doors' unique identity, cementing his status as one of rock's most iconic and influential frontmen. Now we go to our culture correspondent Smithsonian Moss, who has more on the lasting impact of this seminal album.
Now at this point of the evening, we welcome listeners on FM who've just joined us.
Wahoo, you culture vultures. It's Smithsonian Moss slicing through the airwaves like a vinyl on a turntable. Tonight, we're throwing it back to 71 with The Doors and their bluesy swan song, L.A. Woman. Yeah, you heard me. The album that had more soul than a sock with a hole. Now, let's crack open this time capsule. L.A. Woman was the last hurrah with the Lizard King himself, Jim Morrison, before he checked out of the Heartbreak Hotel for good. 2 months and 2 weeks post-drop, and Morrison was off joining that great gig in the sky. Talk about a mic drop, huh? The album sound? Rawer than sushi at a dive bar, baby. They ditched their producer, Paul A. Rothchild, because he was cramping their style with his quality control. Pfft, quality control is for condoms, not rock and roll. So, The Doors got down and dirty with the blues, like they were rolling around in the Mississippi mud. Without Daddy Rothchild, The Doors were free to run wild through the studio, and boy, did they let it rip. They captured the live show lightning in a bottle, and the critics and fans were guzzling it down like it was happy hour. And Jim, oh sweet Jim, with that voice that could seduce a nun and lyrics weirder than a $3 bill, he was the shaman of rock, the Dionysus of the Sunset Strip. His stage antics? More unpredictable than a cat on a hot tin roof. Now Morrison's untimely checkout at 27? That's the cherry on this tragic rock and roll Sunday. He became the poster boy for the 27 Club, a legend shrouded in mystery, like a Bigfoot with a mic. L.A. Woman hit the scene like a freight train, all aboard the Blues Express. Critics were all over it like white on rice, and it sold like hotcakes at a lumberjack convention. The Doors? They were the kings of the rock jungle, and L.A. Woman was their roaring lion. So, there you have it, my little pop culture piranhas. L.A. Woman by The Doors, the album that put the blue in blues and left us all wondering, what would Jim do?
News bang. Unmasking the hidden face of yesterday's tomorrow today.
And now, the final roundup of tomorrow's papers. The Times. Axis powers sweep through Yugoslavia. The Telegraph. Powell's speech sparks Tory turmoil. There's a photograph there of a very stern-looking Enoch. The Guardian. Fuhrer's 50th festivities begin. They've a timeline there of all 50 years. That's it. On the day that the world's longest telegram was sent from New York to Bombay. It was so long that by the time it arrived, it was yesterday. Good night.
Tune in next time for more artificially intelligent hilarity. Newsbang is a comedy show written and recorded by AI. All voices impersonated. Nothing here is real. Good night.